Hello, everybody, and thanks for tuning in. This is a part two of a three-part series on the history behind the Red Hot Chili Peppers album Blood Sugar Sex Magik. Part two starts off in the middle of the band's history, so if you like more context, and if you haven't already, make sure to check out part one of the series. This podcast is a part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and that's supported by Kinexus. Does money spark joy in your life or cause you stress? If you said stress, you're not alone. For 42% of Canadians, their biggest stressor comes from money. At Kinexus, they care about your financial well-being. Money doesn't have to be stressful, and Kinexus is here to help. The Kinexus hashtag MoneyTalk blog provides expert advice, tips, and solutions for all life stages and events. Getting married, buying a house, budgeting, saving, they cover it all and more. And did I mention it's free? Check it out today at kinexusmoneytalk.ca and start feeling confident and stress-free about your money. There's this movie that came out in the early 2000s starring Mark Wahlberg called Rockstar. In it, Mark Wahlberg's character is obsessed with a heavy metal band. He lives and breathes this band called Steel Dragon. Wahlberg's character, who goes by the name of Chris, happens to have a great voice, almost a perfect imitation of Steel Dragon's singer. And so at night, he plays local bars as the frontman in a Steel Dragon tribute band. He has all the posters on the wall, dresses like them, and refuses to play any songs other than Steel Dragon. In the movie, Steel Dragon comes to town for a concert, and Chris makes sure he is standing right in the front row, singing every word, every note to every song throughout the show. The next day, Chris receives a phone call from Kirk Cuddy, guitarist and founding member of Steel Dragon. Kirk explains that he was shown a video of him singing at the concert and tells Chris to come out to Los Angeles and meet the band. The band is having issues with their lead singer, and they were so impressed by the video of Chris that they want to audition him. It's a dream come true for him, so he flies out to LA, meets the guys, gets over his nervousness, and nails the audition. And voila, he's the new lead singer of his favorite band. There's a lot of people in the world that would be classified as diehard fans. Fans that have been to multiple live shows, knows all the words to the songs, knows all the B-sides, knows the deep tracks, knows the story behind the band, and would probably do a lot of things to get the opportunity to audition to be in the band as a member. But when has that happened, really? It's easy to think the story of the movie Rockstar is just Hollywood fluff. Oh, it's silly, that would never happen. Bands don't hire their fans. That's ridiculous. But in 1988... an 18-year-old guitarist by the name of John Frusciante caught just that chance. And he got to audition for his favorite band at the time, and a band whose fan base had been growing steadily over their five-year history to that point. That band was the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
The stories behind some of the most famous albums in music history. It's Beyond the Beat with Jared Lennon.
In 1988, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were gaining in popularity. They had suffered some ups and downs, but nothing too major yet. They had released three albums, all selling more than the next. They had seen a rising number of fans come out to their shows, and had even just wrapped up their first tour of Europe and saw some success there as well. They had a unique sound that got them a lot of attention, especially from the college and indie crowds, but not a lot in the mainstream. The future looked pretty bright for these four kids who formed a punk-funk style band in Los Angeles in 1983. It looked like 1988 was going to be a breakout year for them. But behind the slow success of the band was a dark drug addiction that went from leisurely and fun to an all-familiar fatal turn. On June 25th, 1988, Anthony Kiedis, Flea, and Jack Irons had lost their lead guitarist, and more importantly, their best friend, from a heroin overdose. Hillel Slovak had been battling drug addiction for some time now, but when the band got some leisure time and when they got back from their European tour, it got uncontrollable. Hillel died at the age of 26 and left a huge hole in the band. Hillel's death really hit Flea and Anthony hard. In a recent interview, Anthony talked about how he felt at that time, hearing the news that his best friend had just died, saying, quote, "Devastated beyond, almost impossible to actually fully digest a loss of that size. I don't think any of us really thought that could happen, even though we were pretty messed up at that point." In a separate interview, Anthony talked further on what Hillel meant to him, saying, quote, "Hillel was the closest person to me in my life, and sadly enough, I don't think I can ever find that with anybody else, because I don't think it happens more than once that you get that close to somebody." In a different interview, Flea talked about Hillel's death, about how he'll always have an impact on the band, saying, quote, "The thing that was hardest for me was the feeling of it being unresolved. At that age, you feel like you're about to figure something out, like, how do I relate to life, and what's my mission, and how do I get through this strangling feeling that I got in life? And I felt like Hillel was just starting to figure something out and was stopped. But in retrospect, now I just feel like his spirit really lives on within us, within our band, as well as I feel at peace with it. Time for him to go. And I feel now his spirit is there." In 1988, the hole that Hillel's death had left was just too much for drummer Jack Irons, who had enough of the band's eye for drugs and who straight up quit the band. It was now just Anthony and Flea left in the band, and I can imagine it would have been easy to just call it quits. At what point in a band do you say to yourself, you know what, we've been through so much already, it just doesn't look like the universe wants us to be successful. Let's hang it up, let's focus on a real job and a real career while we're still young. But Anthony and Flea aren't regular people. It's part of what makes the band so great, and they must have truly, truly believed in this band. Their brotherhood proved to be so strong that they didn't want to end what they had built up. After Hillel's death, Anthony tried masking his depression with more heroin, but obviously it just made his situation darker. He fell right off the wagon. He was so messed up that he even missed Hillel's funeral. It was then that Anthony knew he had to do something drastic. He fled to a small fishing village in Mexico, where he tried to kick his habit, and it worked while he was there, but he couldn't keep it up once he got back to LA. Anthony had already found the immense positive benefits of drug rehabilitation centers, and so he checked himself into one with Hillel in the back of his mind. He knew that it was time to get real serious about getting completely sober. It wasn't the first time he would come out of rehab thinking that he was done with drugs, but it was different this time around. I think his semi-successful attempts in the past led him on the right path, and it must have been suffering such a heartbreaking loss that kept him motivated to stay completely sober. Anthony wrote in Scar Tissue about how going to Hillel's gravesite for the first time during his stay at rehab really made an impact on his sobriety, writing, quote, "I was sitting there feeling really awkward about talking to no one, but then I said, 'Yo, Slim,' which was the way I'd always greet Hillel, and it was like this wall came down in a second. I started weeping like I'd never wept before. From that point on, I was a waterfall of blabbering and blubbering and crying and coughing. I had this talk with Hillel and told him how much I missed him, and then I made him the promise. I'm clean. I'm in this rehab. I promise you, I'm not going to put a needle in my arm again. I'm going to stay clean." Now that Anthony was sober, they needed to get back to business with the band. Anthony was re-energized with his new sober lifestyle, and Flea was just as excited and supportive. Now they needed to find a guitarist and a drummer. Luckily, Anthony and Flea had some friends in the music scene who were looking to join bands. D.H. Pellegro, the former drummer for the Dead Kennedys, had played with Anthony and Flea in a joke band before. He was looking for a band, and so that was an easy choice for drums. Also, Dwayne Blackbird McKnight, a former guitarist of one of Anthony's and Flea's favorite bands, Parliament Funkadelic, had previously filled in a few times for Hillel during their last tour. So they decided to try him on as their new full-time guitarist. It looked from the outside that things were getting back to normal, but the new stilts they had built to keep holding the band afloat were still pretty shaky. You see, I don't think you get a masterpiece of art, like what they would later go on to make in Blood Sugar Sex Magik, without some part of tragedy. It seems to be the common thread among very successful artists and musicians, especially the ones that are so critically acclaimed. There's no easy path. Within a few weeks of Anthony now becoming fully sober, it looked as if the Red Hot Chili Peppers were a full-fledged band again. Little did they know that there was still another character to add to this story before things would start taking shape for the band. Anthony spoke about Hillel and these chaotic times in a speech he gave during the induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2012, saying, quote, "We were young men, and we were living hard and very unschooled in the ways of life, and we lost the heart and soul and the architect of the Red Hot Chili Peppers at a very young point in time when he was just getting ready to keep changing the world with his music. He left us with something which was a band and a love and desire to carry on in everything we do. He will always be with us forever. He's with us right now. And like so many things, when disasters happen, beautiful things are born from them. And the next thing that was born was John Frusciante." John Frusciante was born on March 5th, 1970 in New York City to a county judge as a father and a very talented singer as a mother who gave up a career in music to be a stay-at-home mom. His father was also musically gifted but gave up being a professional concert pianist to become a judge. John was an only child and moved around a lot as a kid. They first moved to Arizona when John was little and then Florida, but after his parents got a divorce, John stayed with his mom and then moved to Los Angeles. John was not even into his teens when he first got into music, especially punk rock music, and especially LA punk band, The Germs. That's when he picked up his first guitar, listening in on The Germs' record GI, and began studying the instrument in all the songs. He soon got into guitarists like Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page, but both Frank Zappa and Jimi Hendrix were probably his biggest influences on him as a guitar player. John first heard of the Red Hot Chili Peppers in 1984, when his guitar teacher mentioned the band to him after his teacher failed an audition with them. John saw a little of them on MTV and went to his first Chili Peppers concert at the age of 15. In an interview, John talked about what drew him into the band as a fan, saying, quote, "This incredible force that made everyone in the club feel great. They lit up the room. That's an incredible power to have when you're no different from anyone else until you get on stage and everyone else is rocking out with you. I think that's the thing that made Anthony and Flea stick with it and stick with each other, that magical power." John became a huge fan of the band, and he was even able to meet and talk to one of his guitar heroes at the time, Hillel, at the last Chili Peppers concert John would attend as a fan. I find this conversation fascinating because in a weird way, it's a type of foreshadowing. The Chili Peppers were growing steadily at this time, and although they weren't a full-fledged arena band yet, the boys were optimistic about the future, and they were growing in popularity. At that show, Hillel asked John, who was 17 at the time, if he would still like the Chili Peppers if they ever got so popular that they were able to play at places like the LA Forum, which held about 17,000 people. John said no, and that it would ruin everything that's great about the band, including the feeling the fans experience in their intimate shows. He talked about this encounter in an interview, justifying his position by saying, quote, "I didn't even watch the shows. I'd get so excited that I'd flip around the slam pit the whole time. I really felt like a part of the band, and all the sensitive people in the audience did too. So I couldn't picture the band playing the LA Forum." Obviously, John stuck to his guns, and crazily enough, later, in the aftermath of the success of Blood Sugar Sex Magik, some 4 or 5 years after this encounter with Hillel, John would remain feeling the same way. He would end up quitting the band for that very reason, and ironically, John's presence had a large part in taking them to that level of fame, but we'll get to that later. From hanging around LA's punk scene in the mid to late 80s, John became close with the mutual friends of Anthony's and Flea's, who happened to be a drummer. This guy ended up introducing John to Flea, and just for fun, played a bit together, started jamming and noticing musical chemistry. They thought nothing of it and just saw it as fun, but remained friendly towards each other. But cut to 1988, just 2 months after having that foreshadowing type conversation with Hillel, John learned of Hillel's death and was devastated that one of his favorite guitarists had passed away. Anthony and Flea had already replaced Hillel with Dwayne Blackbird McKnight on guitar by this time, but friends of Anthony and Flea's were looking for a guitarist in another band, so they were more than happy to introduce John to the band for an audition. Anthony and Flea sat in on the audition and quickly realized what they had missed out on. Blackbird McKnight was the wrong guitarist for the Chili Peppers. In an interview, John talked about the series of events that led him into auditioning for the Chili Peppers, saying, quote, "I had played before with Flea a couple of times, but he wouldn't give me a chance to audition and hired Blackbird. But it wasn't working out. He saw me audition for Thelonious Monster and went back to Anthony and said, 'That guy's got to be in the Chili Peppers.' They asked me if I wanted the job, and I said yes, more than anything in the world. That night, they fired Blackbird and hired me." In another interview, John said he got a call from both Flea and Anthony telling him he was in the band, saying, quote, "I kept real cool when I was on the phone with them, and then I hung up the phone, and then I screamed, 'I'm in the Red Hot Chili Peppers!' And I ran across the house, and I jumped on a wall, and there was like these footmarks on the wall of the apartment." It was obvious right away that he fit in much better in the band, not just what he brought to the table on guitar, but how his personality fit in. He became genuine friends with Anthony and Flea, something both of them missed after Hillel had died. It looked like the Red Hot Chili Peppers had a new guitarist again. John got the experience millions of guitarists around the world only dream of. He got the call to be in his favorite band, and he got to live the Mark Wahlberg character from Rockstar more than a decade before that movie was even created. I want to talk a little about the chemistry John had with the rest of the Chili Peppers, especially Flea. It's hard to talk about chemistry, because really, what is chemistry? It's something that two people feel, a connection that is indescribable, I guess, and by all accounts, it's something that John and Flea discovered almost instantly. A musical chemistry that was different from what Hillel and Flea had, not saying it was worse or better, but different. And what would shape the sound of the band going forward? That chemistry is something that you can't plan, something you can't force, and I guess just something you have to credit the mysterious forces of the universe. It almost gets into woo-woo territory. If you saw the Chili Peppers live in concert back when John was in the band, you would have noticed how Flea and John would have these jams in between some of the songs, where they would improvise on the guitar together, and they would walk towards each other and look each other in the eye, and you could just tell there was something special about it. And you could see the excitement in both their faces. If you want to see a good example of it, go on YouTube and search for their live show at Fuji Rock in 2006 and watch their jam at the very end of the show after Give It Away. You can see that chemistry displayed right on their faces. John has the biggest shit-eating grin on his face, and it looks like Flea is so happy he's about to cry. I mean, that's got to be an example of chemistry in the flesh. And I think, going back to when John first joined the band, both Flea and John knew that they had that chemistry and something special right away. So now John is in the band, along with their new drummer and John's old buddy, D.H. Pellegrino, who replaced Jack Irons. On paper, everything seemed like it was working out great. John already knew D.H. from before, and everyone seemingly was getting along great. Except not really. After Hillel died, Flea and Anthony started to look at drug use a lot differently. I mean, of course they did. Their best friend just died from a drug overdose. Anthony was now completely sober, and he was very anti-drugs, but those urges of addiction were still there. D.H. Pellegrino didn't see drugs in the same way and was a pretty heavy user of drugs and alcohol at the time, so it wasn't long before Flea and Anthony saw that it wasn't going to work out. It wasn't easy for Anthony and Flea to fire him, as they were still very good friends with Pellegrino, but they knew it was necessary. Flea says that at that time, that it wasn't just the drugs, though, but that they were in need of a drummer who is more versatile as a musician, as well as less on the path of self-destruction that they were trying to stay off of after losing Hillel. John's first live show experiences with the Chili Peppers would actually be Pellegrino's last in his short stint as drummer. The band went on a brief tour, mainly designed to break in John as their new guitarist, but the tour amplified the reasons Pellegrino was not fitting in, and so he was shown the door once they got back to L.A. They were now out of options on the drums, so they decided to go to their last resort and hold auditions for a new drummer. With the chemistry coming along greatly with John now in the band, Anthony and Flea were eager to start rehearsing for their fourth album, but drummer auditions didn't go as smoothly as they would have liked. They met, jammed with, and eventually said no to countless drummers before the ending of the scheduled audition process was drawing near. The band was exhausted from meeting all these guys, trying to figure out if they could fit in, have the drumming chops, and be able to hang with them off stage. It was at that time when in walked a big, tall, long-haired, bandana-clad, heavy metal-looking dude who looked more like he belonged as the drummer for Guns N' Roses rather than the drummer for a cool underground punk funk rock band called the Red Hot Chili Peppers. This guy had got the audition because his friend happened to know John's girlfriend at the time, and his friend had made up a story and told John that this guy eats drums for breakfast. The drummer's name was Chad Smith, and he talked about his first encounter with the Chili Peppers in an interview, saying, quote, "When I walked in, the first person I see is Flea, and I'm walking in with my drums, and he's like, 'So, man, is that your breakfast? You know, just a little guy. It was kind of weird, you know?'" He went on talking about finding that chemistry right away in his audition, saying, quote, "I just went in and we just did what we basically do to this day. We just improvised and just jammed and just take notes out of the air and just start playing. And Flea starts a bass line and I start playing and we just jam. And there was this musical explosion in that little room and it was so fun. They had so much energy. I remember Anthony, he wasn't singing. He was just kind of dancing around the room and he was laughing his ass off." Chad Smith was born on October 25th, 1961, and grew up in a suburb just outside of Detroit, Michigan. Chad started practicing drums at the age of 7, although never receiving any formal training, and his musical tastes were influenced mostly by his older brother Brad, who listened to a mix of a lot of the classic 70s rock that we know of, especially bands like Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin, but also a lot of Motown bands as well, as they grew up right near the Motown hub. Chad wasn't really into funk music until he started drumming for a band called Pharaoh in the early 80s. Chad was the drummer, but they also had a percussionist by the name of Larry Fratangelo, who had previously been the percussionist for a band that has been brought up a lot in this podcast, Parliament Funkadelic. Chad credits Larry for being a huge influence on his drumming style, saying how Larry helped change Chad from just a drummer keeping the beat into more of a musician as a crucial part of a band, teaching him dynamics and how to build a song. Of course, Parliament Funkadelic was a huge influence on Anthony and Flea and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, with frontman George Clinton even producing their Freaky Styley record. Fratangelo helped bridge the gap for Chad between a more hard-hitting classic rock, maybe John Bonham and Keith Moon style of drumming, to groovy and smooth funk patterns. By the late 80s, Chad had been in a number of semi-successful bands, but nothing really took off from the club circuit he felt stuck in. So he decided to do what all wide-eyed musicians with big aspirations were doing at the time, and move to Los Angeles. It wasn't very long before Chad's connection to the band, his friend who knew John's girlfriend at the time, landed him the audition. And the rest is history. In an interview, Chad talked about his first reaction to hearing about an audition with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, saying, quote, "I wasn't like a big fan of the band or anything. I was like, oh yeah, the guys with socks on their dicks. Yeah, I've heard of them. Oh, they got a record deal. Yeah, I'll try out for them." In the book An Oral Visual History, Flea says Chad didn't look the part and he kind of had a bad first impression on the rest of the band, saying, quote, "He had the headband and the long hair and the heavy metal guy jacket, and I was like, I hate heavy metal guys. We were underground punk rockers. We were like, those are the enemy, the hair metal guys." In an interview, Chad said before they even played together, they kind of tested each other's personalities out, saying, quote, "I had a mullet, more of a new wavy kind of poodle cut, and they said, 'Will you shave your head?' And I said, 'Fuck you, you shave yours.' And they're like, 'He's fucking punk rock telling us to fuck off.'" Flea said in the Oral Visual History book, quote, "I thought he's so goofy, this guy will never do, but then we started playing, and he was so fucking on fire. I was laughing so hard while we were playing, going, 'Oh my God, he's so good.' I just remember him screaming and destroying the drums." I talked earlier about John and Flea's chemistry, but I think it was definitely felt with Chad as well. He had a different drum style than Jack Irons, and I think it impressed the hell out of the other members of the band. He came off as a heavy metal guy, but as soon as he sat down on the kit, he was playing right with all the punk and funk John and Flea could throw at him. His musical sensibility was different, but his energy and passion and the raw power he had for creating rhythm really set Chad apart from the previous drummers in the band. As Anthony has said, Cliff was artistic and creative and intricate. Jack Irons was very much the simple metronome, but Chad was moving more air than had ever been moved by a drummer, giving the band a new vibe. Flea said he was being led by the drums for the first time, something he wasn't used to because he commanded such a presence on the bass guitar. In an interview, Chad said the band, and especially Flea and John, wanted him after that first audition, and his life was now turned upside down, saying, quote, "A month after the audition, I was taking pictures in a magazine with a sock on my dick, so it was, I guess I'm in the band." By February of 1989, 8 months after Hillel's death and what many probably thought was going to be the demise of the band, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were officially a full band again. It was a year of drastic changes. Anthony was now sober, Flea had become a father for the first time, and two new faces were now in the band. It was now time to begin pre-production on their fourth album and get some positive momentum going again. All four members now hit the rehearsal space to begin writing songs for the album that would later be called Mother's Milk. Some of the early beginnings of songs had actually been written before Chad even joined the band, but with him now in the mix, they were coming together more easily. Just like how they used to come up with songs, and just like how they still do it to this day, they came in with little parts they had come up with, jammed for hours on end, and picked apart the new stuff they liked, and threw away everything else. They experimented. One example of the new look at Red Hot Chili Peppers and how they would start doing things a little differently took place soon after John joined the band. Like I said, they normally would jam and come up with some music, and then Anthony would write some lyrics to match the music. But when John first joined the band, he'd specifically told Anthony that he'd like to see any material he'd come up with and tell him any ideas he had and that they could write a song together. It wasn't what Anthony was used to, but it got him excited, and right away he showed John a piece of lyrics that he had been working on. It was a cautionary song that described what it was like to be a drug addict, to have that ego, and to think you were impenetrable and impervious to the forces of nature. But it was also a love song for Hillel. Anthony had pages and pages of lyrics, but no melody or structure. John took a look at the lyrics, studied them, experimented with a few things, and in a few minutes, he had come up with a complete verse melody. Anthony wrote about this new songwriting experience in his book Scar Tissue, writing, quote, "This was a real epiphany. Okay, here's another way songs can be written. Even when Hillel was there, everything we wrote was in a group context. Flea and I had written songs together, but it was different on the bass. Now I felt I could write anything, a melody, a rhythm, a lyric, and go to this new friend of mine and sit down, and when we left that session, we'd have a song. I felt like anything was possible with this kid. I could show him my most sentimental writings, and he didn't stop to judge them once. There was no moment when he read the lyrics to see if he liked them or if there was something he wanted to do. Whatever I'd written had to be a song. Now I didn't have to second-guess myself or be afraid to show something or try something new, which opened up the avenue for writing songs and making cool music." That first song, where John came up with a melody to match Anthony's lyrics, turned out to be a song called Knock Me Down, and would eventually be the first single off their new album, Mother's Milk. It was written in a more traditional path and was a new element that would contribute to the band's changing sound, as opposed to the bulk of their past music being built from rhythm upwards, being groove-based, and starting with bass lines. The writing process for this new album went very smoothly for the band, and a hell of a lot smoother than the previous records. I attribute this to two main factors. Number one, the band, and especially Anthony, were finally sober. During the Uplift Mofo party plan, the band would sometimes wait around for hours for Anthony to show up during the peak of his heroin addiction. Now, Anthony was sober, and he had a new outlook on life, and that translated into being very productive. The second factor, I think, had to do with John and Chad both joining the band. They brought some new perspective into the mix, and it got Flea and Anthony very excited about writing new material. Chad brought a more hard and fast style of drumming, but especially holds true with John joining the band. John's style of guitar is not very rooted in funk and more classic rock. His main influences were more Jimi Hendrix mixed with punk rock, more than, say, a funk style, and so that definitely shaped how the songs were turning out. That's not to say John didn't know the type of band the Chili Peppers were. He knew that Flea was deeply rooted in funk, and so he studied funk guitarists to try figure out a style that would fit more into the sound of the Chili Peppers, saying in an interview, quote, "I wasn't really a funk player before I joined the band. I learned everything I needed to know about how to sound good with Flea by studying Hillel's playing, and I just took it sideways from there. Anthony and Flea were both happy with their experience with producer Michael Beinhorn during their last record, so they decided to go with him again. Although things went a lot more smoothly this time around on the productive side of things, it didn't mean that Beinhorn and the band agreed on everything. Beinhorn was very focused on creating a hit single, and that caused a lot of pressure on the band. Not only that, but he recognized the need for this album to be a commercial success for the Chili Peppers, and so he insisted on the band members doing their takes over and over again until they were almost perfect. Beinhorn put extra attention on their cover of Stevie Wonder's Higher Ground because he saw the potential in the song to be a hit single. Flea had already been playing that cool slap bass riff in that song for years, and John and Chad had come up with some monster parts as well. But according to Anthony, Beinhorn went through hell and high water with John to play the layered sound on the cut. Not only that, he pushed Anthony very hard on the vocals, which for Anthony at the time was daunting, frustrating, and challenging. The vocals for a song like that was not Anthony's forte, and so having Beinhorn push him so hard really put tension on the relationship. The straw that broke the camel's back in terms of what would push Anthony into not bringing back Beinhorn to produce future albums was when he insisted on Anthony doing ad-libs at the end of the Higher Ground recording. Anthony said he couldn't take Beinhorn's direction any longer. He was trying to squeeze something out of Anthony that he wasn't feeling, and it ended up in a huge fight that they never recovered from. The band ended up being very proud of Higher Ground, though. They were proud they made it their own, a high-energy, funk-driven take on Stevie Wonder's classic song that teamed up Flea's funky bass line with some heavy power riffing from John. They called up a bunch of their friends to come into the studio for the song to record the big chanting choruses, and it ended up sounding great. It had a great party vibe to it, and so they ended up shooting a music video for it, trying to capture that party feeling with shots of the band playing the song in front of green screen psychedelic patterns moving around like crazy. The song would end up seeing commercial success as well with the help of that video, and it wound up as their second single off the album. Another part of Beinhorn's process to achieve commercial success with this album was his insistence on creating big, crunching, metal-sounding songs, especially when it came to guitar sounds. It must have been tough for John, just 18 years old, joining this band, wanting to make Anthony and Flea happy by playing more of a Hillel type of style guitar, but also trying to please the producer with heavier guitar. You could eventually really hear that influence on the album, as it was definitely the Chili Peppers' heaviest album to date. John also gave the Chili Peppers more of a melodic style of songwriting to the band, as well as more complex song structures and more harmonies. You see the early aspects of his influence on songs like Knock Me Down, where John sang the song as a duet with Anthony, and also hearing his prominent background vocals on a number of the songs, including Higher Ground. John brought a lot of these aspects to the band at the start, and it was exciting. He even helped coach Anthony in singing more melodically, going through the melodies on his guitar for Anthony to sing along to. But John didn't have the confidence yet just to fully bring his potential to the table. I mean, he was only in the band for a few months, and he was 18, so you gotta cut the guy some slack too. You think back to my analogy at the start of the Mark Wahlberg movie Rockstar, this was John's favorite band. He worshipped these guys, and now on paper, he's essentially an equal. He's their peer and bandmate and is now looked at to speak up when he disagrees with Anthony and Flea or to show the rest of the guys his ideas on creative direction. John talked about this period in the book, In Oral Visual History of the Chili Peppers, saying, quote, "The first year or so, I wanted to be in the band so bad. I wanted to do a good job so much. I was trying too hard to be like what I thought a Chili Pepper should be rather than just being myself, musically and in my personal life." He also talked about that although he had the chops to rip it up like an Eddie Van Halen, it was a learning experience of serving what was best for the song, saying, quote, "I owe a lot to Hillel for where I went with my playing. Like if I tried to compete with Flea's bass playing at its busiest, it was screwing up the chemistry, so I started simplifying everything to suit the limitations Hillel's playing is based around." Going on about it further, saying, quote, "It taught me to let the music breathe more, so that other instruments could breathe more, so that when Flea does his busy things, it really means something." He even went on to say that it helped carve his own path on the guitar, saying, quote, "By removing the pressure of trying to do something impressive, I started to get more original. The more originality flourished." During the writing and recording of Mother's Milk, John was still battling creatively with this inner struggle of trying to please the rest of the band members by sounding like Hillel against trying to put his own original stamp on the album. But it was a great training ground for what was to come later. And you can definitely see the early stages of what made Blood Sugar Sex Magik so great and so accessible to the mainstream. I mean, that's two of the main aspects of pop music, right? Melody and harmony. But like I said, he contributed to the songwriting process, coming up with more original and complex song structures, never mind coming up with some great classic, cool, original guitar riffs. So you can see how he slowly implemented this into the Red Hot Chili Peppers for Mother's Milk and went full steam ahead with it on Blood Sugar Sex Magik. Another big change from previous albums is Anthony taking another step forward and singing in a more melodic style, rather than mostly just rap. Look no further than the song Knock Me Down, as I mentioned before, as just pure vocal melody throughout the whole song, which was a huge departure from the old style of Anthony's rapping. Also, Anthony seemed to improve and dial in his old style of part rapping, part yelling. The song Good Time Boys is a perfect example. It's the opening track and opens the record with much of the high energy in your face style of old, but it just seems more polished. Anthony is much clearer and sharper, and the band never sounded so huge. The chorus in Good Time Boys reflects the rest of the album well, a wall of voices type chant that would become the trademark for Mother's Milk. Going back to Knock Me Down, the song not only featured a new vocal style for Anthony, but a new introspective way of looking at lyrics. Before this, Anthony mostly just wrote about sex and how much he loved his friends, but after Hillel's death, he took a new approach. He had a new outlook on life with his newfound sobriety, and wrote about this in Knock Me Down. He talked about the negatives of being addicted to drugs and the internal struggles and lyrics like, quote, "Don't be afraid to show your friends that you hurt inside, inside. Pain's part of life, don't hide behind your false pride. It's a lie, your lie." And also about an inflated ego when you're young and addicted to drugs, with, quote, "If you see me getting mighty, if you see me getting high, knock me down. I'm not bigger than life." Also in the song, Anthony talks about Hillel in lyrics like, quote, "I'm part of you and you're part of me. Why did you go away? Finding what you're looking for can end up being such a bore. I pray for you most every day. My love's with you. Now fly away." This was a huge step for Anthony, and it gave him a lot of confidence to write more of what he's feeling, and it gave him the confidence he needed to write future songs like an Under the Bridge, for example. Anthony actually didn't want Knock Me Down to be looked at as some anti-drugs song, surprisingly. He said the song is about letting your friends know that you need help, and then being willing to accept the help of others when you need it, whether it's from drugs or a number of other personal problems. The song ends with one line repeated, quote, "It's so lonely when you don't even know yourself." Anthony wrote about that one line in particular in his book Scar Tissue, writing, quote, "That ending is lonely, sad, but true. Those are the feelings you feel when you're out there and enough dark energy possesses you and you think, who the fuck am I? What happened to me?" I'm sure that was where Hillel ended up. He so clearly knew who he was and what he wanted early in his life, and he was determined and hardworking, creative, life-loving guy. By the end, he forgot who he was, which I've seen happen to many people. Another song that sampled Anthony's more mature look at lyrics was the album's closing song, Johnny, Kick a Hole in the Sky. Anthony had found out that he was part Native American, and so in this song, he wrote about his empathy for Native Americans. He expresses his feelings about how poorly the Native Americans were treated by the government in the past, as well as in the present. In his lyrics, he also mentions the way America is put high on a pedestal of glory during the settling of the American West in the 1800s, and that a lot of the history books don't accurately show the mistreatment of the Native Americans, writing, quote, "When history books are full of shit, I become the anarchist. I'm pissed at this. What this country claims to be, it's a lie. No place for me. I bleed." Anthony also wrote about the confusion he felt being mostly of white heritage, writing, quote, "What am I supposed to do? I feel like I'm cut in two, confused by rules. Do these two cultures clash or am I living in the past? I ask, please tell me fast." It's pretty heavy stuff to be tackling on a lyrical standpoint, and it marked just the beginning of him tapping into how he really felt and having the confidence to write and sing about it. Anthony even used the written album credits to express his feelings further on the Native American experience, thanking Sitting Bull for killing Custer. For the drums on this record, you definitely notice a harder, faster, and grittier drum sound coming from Chad Smith as opposed to the more clean Jack Irons. The drums in a song like Magic Johnson, for example, just smacks you in the face for how fast and how much is going on for the full 4 minutes plus long song. Just the speed of some of the songs would be hard for any drummer to keep up. And for bass, just listen to the opening riff of Nobody Weird Like Me. Flea has mentioned in interviews before that it's the hardest song to perform live that he's ever written. It's so punk rock, with just a little taste of funk mixed in. Oh, and Chad kills it on the drums on this one as well. It's just so fast. Interestingly enough, Nobody Weird Like Me is the only other song from this album, besides Higher Ground, that the band plays during live shows to this day for more than a one or two off, after they brought it back during shows in support of the Getaway album, and it wasn't even released as a single. Oh, and I haven't even talked about Pretty Little Ditty, which is probably one of my favorite songs on the record. It stands out because it's an instrumental with mostly just bass and guitar, with Chad coming in on the drums at the end. It also features Flea on the trumpet, which actually was his first instrument to pick up. It also stands out because it's so calm and unique, and it's one of the few songs on the album to not feature any guitar layering. You probably heard it sampled and featured as the main riff in the massive late 90s rap rock hit Butterfly by Crazy Town as well. Overall, Mother's Milk was the biggest Red Hot Chili Peppers record to date. It peaked at number 52 on the Billboard Top 200 and was certified gold by March of 1990. Two big singles probably helped propel it that way. The first, Knock Me Down, charted at number 6 on the US Modern Rock chart. Their second was their cover of Higher Ground, which charted at number 11. Although to date, Higher Ground is probably the most famous song from the album, being one of the first singles to be played regularly on radio, but also being featured in a ton of movies. It's still played by the band during live shows to this day, and they even finished their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame performance with this song. A large part of the success of how the album sold was also probably in part to a new genre hitting the masses in radio. Alternative music, as it was labeled by the record companies, kind of put college radio and new modern rock under one umbrella, and a lot of commercial radio stations converted to this new thing once it was converted into a nice, easy, explainable pie for the masses who listen to radio. The Red Hot Chili Peppers fit perfectly into this new umbrella, a previously solid college radio band that built a loyal fan base. Both Knock Me Down and Higher Ground got a lot of airplay on these new alternative radio stations, and the videos for both got a lot of play on MTV. And not just some spot play they received for previous videos in the past, like True Men Don't Kill Coyotes and Jungle Land, but mainstream play. The Chili Peppers were making noise and really at the forefront of this new alternative genre that would eventually explode into grunge in the early 90s. Overall, you can see how Mother's Milk is a nice bridge from the old Red Hot Chili Peppers into the new. A bridge from the extreme fast punk rock, funk style of music into more of a cool new sound that was just a bit more accessible, but still had the old flavors of the band that made them cool in the first place. A bridge from the underground to mainstream. A bridge that was necessary in feeling out two new band members and how they would fit in the band and what changes that would induce. The band was justifiably proud of their fourth album. Their playing was stronger, the songs were arguably better written, and Beinhorn's production really shone a light on the band's strengths. Up to this point, their record company EMI didn't even consider the Chili Peppers as a mainstream act, never mind any hints of superstardom. They were the silly Los Angeles band who would sell enough albums to justify their relatively low recording budgets. But that changed with Mother's Milk. By April of 1990, the album was certified gold. EMI tried swooning over the band by throwing a big party for them, but Anthony and Flea both knew it was time for a record label change. Their lawyers found a clause in their record contract that could get them out of it 7 years after the band had signed it, which is coming up quick. Anthony and Flea wanted a record company that would support them, and this clause would mark the end of their time with EMI. This was just the start for the new lineup in the Red Hot Chili Peppers. A young John Frusciante, who knew all the guitar licks and practiced all the songs from home, was now realizing a dream come true. He was now an equal member of his favorite band, and would now help propel that band to crazy new heights. His songwriting would give the band's rap rock blend a much needed infusion of melody, and with that, the band was starting to mature a bit more, and the songs were featuring more emotional truth. This was an exciting time for the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and you got to imagine a huge relief for Anthony and Flea. Things were dark for a long time, and it finally seemed as though things were clicking again and in a new direction. Mother's Milk laid quite the foundation for the band, and in 1991, just 2 years after Mother's Milk's release, they continued where they left off. Although this time, the stars seemed to align on a number of different fronts. The chemistry within the band was only getting stronger, a new producer would be introduced, and pop culture was going to shift radically. The Red Hot Chili Peppers would soon see more success than they probably ever imagined, but little did they know, it would bring a whole new set of problems into the mix. Hey guys, thanks again for listening to part 2 of a 3-part series on the history behind Blood Sugar Sex Magik. If you'd like to keep up to date on when part 3 will be coming out, be sure to follow the Beyond the Beat podcast on Instagram. And if you'd like some of these stories condensed a little bit and in video form, check out the Beyond the Beat YouTube channel with a focus on short individual stories. And hey, if you have any suggestions on albums you'd like to hear about in future podcasts, let me know on Instagram or YouTube. Thanks again.